students have empathy.
Yeah.
Be sure to take care of yourself.
Yes.
I mean, some of these are really contradictory statements of make all these connections, but have boundaries. It's a balancing act, and
yeah,
acknowledging that that balance needs to exist because you can't help other people if you don't help yourself first.
Yeah.
So I guess that would be my big thing.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for being a teacher and
thanks.
Working with the population you do that's so vulnerable, and I want to see more care from our world for this, you know, extreme
autism. Everybody should be nice to their teachers.
Yes.
Taking care of them.
Yes, they're working hard out there. And again, just thank you for your friendship over the years and the light that you bring into my life.
Oh.
And yeah, you're just so fun to be with and around. And I love your sense of humor and your playfulness. And you're just such a rock star in my mind, too. Single mom, 3 kids.
Yeah.
Amazing teacher.
Thanks.
And yeah. Okay. Thank you. And thank you all for joining. All My Greatest Teachers Showed Me Love. And yep, be kind out there and take care of each other. Thanks for joining us. Bye.
Desire, swimming in the lake of fire, born my altar reignite,
cry
for revival. Too weary to bear the weight of this heartache, prayed I would see the beauty in the mundane rise, a little lighter.
Hi, I'm David Brower, David R. Brower, and I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States, and that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland, and I wish you had a lot more company.
Hey, everybody. Your friendly neighborhood radio DJ, DJ Weasel Squeeze, a.k.a. Vortex James Kemp. Yes, the one and only James Kemp coming at you for National Radio Day. National Radio Day means a lot to KBOO. KBOO has been at this for over 50 years, and they mean a lot to the Portland community and surrounding areas. But they mean a lot to me because I've been in the area as a transplant for the last 10 years. As a photographer in the music industry, I used to work and volunteer with Vortex Music Magazine, and if it wasn't for KBOO giving me the outlet to share my voice as a photographer over the airwaves with Chris Young, the founder, during one of their celebrations, talking about the magazine, talking about the music industry, talking about me as a photographer overall, I don't think I would be where I'm at today, and that is volunteering here at KBOO. And the radio is someplace I've always wanted to be, and to make an impact and to continue the legacy as being a part of, you know, that KBOO family means nothing but the world to me. And I'm really appreciative for that because I'm able to help the youth kids out at the Youth Collective to put on a great, you know, youth program for you at KBOO. I've been afforded the opportunity to write news and also host live remote anchors for you guys. And now KBOO means even more to me than it has over the last 10 years because my oldest son is now part of the youth collective and he loves KBOO and he loves producing media just like I do and everybody else within the station. We love producing content for you like KBOO has done over the last 50 years for Portland and the surrounding communities. So thank you for all of your support during National Radio Day and into the future.
KBOO Community Radio's annual meeting and board election will take place on Saturday, September 20th at 11:30 a.m. at Mississippi Studios in North Portland. The meeting will include a state of the station presented by KBOO's Board of Directors and an opportunity for members to meet the candidates running in the board election. KBOO will introduce its 2026 to 2027 operating plan and will present its first Diane Carl Mentorship Award. New directors will be announced at the meeting, followed by a musical performance by Mr. Vail's math class. Again, KBOO Community Radio's annual meeting and board election will be held on Saturday, September 20th at 11:30 a.m. at Mississippi Studios, located at 3939 North Mississippi Avenue. Doors open at 11 a.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm/board25.
Is it possible that the more we study the universe, the stranger it appears?
We know that 95% of the matter and energy in the universe is invisible, and it's made of substances that we have no understanding of.
After scientists detected the elusive Higgs boson, it seemed like the big questions about the universe were answered. But as it turns out, not only are there more particles out there, get ready for beauty quarks and glue balls, but we also have more questions about the fundamental forces that define the universe. Our models predict one thing, our observations reveal something different. For example, the existence of dark energy and dark matter doesn't fit into what's called the standard model of particle physics that scientists use. I'm Molly Bentley. In this episode of Big Picture Science from the SETI Institute, we explore how new physics experiments are shaking up cosmology, why the universe is stranger than we thought, and why it may be time for us to go beyond the standard model. As we get better at science exploration, things get weirder, but this is natural. First, you identify the big things, like how large objects move according to Newtonian physics, and then the more you study, you find things that don't fit in with the model, such as how objects behave on the quantum scale. And sometimes, finding that things don't fit in with your model raises some of the most exciting questions.
I don't see how you wouldn't be excited by these questions, right? I mean, you're talking about, you know, what are we made from? How did we get here? You know, how did the universe create the world that we live in? I don't think there are many more profound questions than that. So I think that's the, in a really big picture sense, that's what has always excited me about physics.
It's a lot to get our head around, and to help us guide our journey through the known and the unknown universe, we are happy to be joined again by longtime friend of Big Picture Science, astronomer Phil Plait. Phil spent many years working on Hubble before turning to science communication. He now writes for Scientific American, and his most recent book is Under Alien Skies, A Sightseer's Guide to the Universe. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Molly. Thanks for having me on again.
You are an astronomer, but we are going to dive into some particle physics in this show. Does being an astronomer prepare you for a discussion of particle physics?
I don't know if being an astronomer does as much as being a science communicator, because I try to stay up on many aspects of science. But in fact, everything you can see is made of particles. So there is a sort of a, pardon the pun, fundamental overlap between particle physics and astrophysics. So there's a lot going on that we have to be familiar with in astronomy.
Well, we're really happy to have you as our guide. So we're going to listen to the interview with Harry Cliff, and then you'll join us after the interview again, of course, to help put all of this into perspective. Well, as Phil said, everything is made of particles, and we're going to hear why what's called the standard model of particle physics is now being called into question. But let's begin with what the model is.
So the standard model is our current best theory describing the fundamental particles that make up the world around us. So it describes essentially the matter particles that make up the atoms in our bodies, and it describes the forces that hold them together. So there are 17 different particles in this theory, and then there are four different force particles. So basically, it's this mathematical framework which describes how all of these things behave, and it makes really stunningly accurate predictions about pretty much every experiment we've ever done. So it's actually, in some sense, I mean, it's got this very boring name, the standard model, but in some sense, it's the closest we've come to a theory of everything. It's this amazing intellectual achievement, possibly one of the greatest intellectual achievements of human beings. But it's our current theory, and we know it's incomplete. So it's not the end of the story, despite its all its successes, and that's why we're trying to find new stuff. So I'm Harry Cliff. I'm a research fellow in particle physics at the University of Cambridge in the UK, and I'm also the author of Space Oddities, the Mysterious Anomalies Challenging Our Understanding of the Universe.
And you are working at CERN, right?
Oh, yeah, and I also work at CERN at the Large Hadron Collider, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that other thing that I do.
I don't know what length of biography you wanted, but yeah, I can go on for longer if you like.
Harry, it's been about a decade now since the scientists at CERN detected the Higgs boson. Remind us how detecting the Higgs helps us understand the universe and why detecting it was a big deal.
The Higgs is really central to essentially why we exist. I mean, people often say, oh, it's responsible for giving mass to particles, which is true. But in some sense, it's even more important than that. If the Higgs did not exist, we would not exist. Basically, atoms would not have structure. Everything in the universe would fall to pieces. And, you know, there'd be nothing. There would be no stars, galaxies, no people. So it's absolutely fundamental to our understanding of why we have a physical world. The discovery of the Higgs boson, this particle, the reason it's exciting is it's not so much that we discovered a new particle, it's that it's telling us that there is this thing out there in the universe called the Higgs field, which exists. And the Higgs field is this invisible field. We think it fills the entire universe, and it's this field that is responsible for giving mass to the particles that we're made from, the fundamental particles. So we're made of electrons and quarks. Well, electrons and quarks get their mass from this Higgs field thing. So you take away the Higgs field, that whole picture falls apart, nothing works. So that's why finding it was so crucial.
But Harry, couldn't you say that about any particle? Take away the proton and it all falls apart. You know, take away maybe one of these quarks and it all falls apart. Was there anything unique about Higgs?
Well, in some sense, the Higgs sets the rules of the game in a way. So, yeah, I mean, you could think about there are about 17 particles that we know about. And some of them you probably could remove and nothing obviously bad would happen. Some of them, like the electron, you take the electron away, okay, yeah, well, then we're screwed. There's nothing to make atoms anymore. But the Higgs, in some sense, it basically dictates the structure of the physics that makes up our universe. So because it sets the masses of the particles, that determines, you know, what are the particles that actually are stable, which particles can therefore come together to form atoms. Not only that, it also sets the strength of one of the forces, the weak force. So that this is one of the fundamental forces in our current picture of the universe. If the Higgs field had a different value, that force would act very, very differently. And that would have pretty dramatic consequences for, you know, for example, radioactivity or whether the sun shines, all these kinds of things. So it basically, the Higgs is right in the middle of this picture. And if you alter it, it alters everything else. It has a knock-on effect on all the other particles. If you took away the electron, that wouldn't change necessarily the structure of the rest of what we call the standard model. Obviously, it would be bad for us because we need electrons to exist. But the Higgs really does play this central, almost as a conductor of the other particles in some sense.
Well, Harry, given all of that fanfare and all the excitement around the discovery of the Higgs boson, one could be forgiven for assuming that after that, we kind of put a cap on the open question of what the universe is made of. But you're here to say there's more to it. And apparently, according to you, something strange is going on in the cosmos.
Yeah, I mean, we are very far from understanding what the universe is made from. And there's this really stark fact that from astronomy, we know that 95% of the matter and energy in the universe is invisible. And it's made of substances that we have no understanding of. So the Higgs boson completes this theory we have of the known particles called the Standard Model of Particle Physics. Now, it's an incredibly successful theory. It describes all of the physical matter that we can see in the universe, the stuff that we're made from, the stuff that the galaxies and stars are made from. It does it brilliantly accurately, but we know it's only describing 5% of the universe. So there is a 95% stuff out there which we have no clue what it is. We have two labels for this stuff. One is dark matter, another is dark energy, and the Standard Model has no explanation for either of them. So that on that basis alone, we know there must be more to be discovered fundamentally. We think there must be particles or fields that are responsible for these dark things, but we don't know what they are. So that's why we do experiments at the Large Hadron Collider, for example, to try and find evidence for new particles that could explain some of these mysteries.
I wonder if you could say more about that, because we've been talking about the theories around dark energy and dark matter for a long time. The idea that dark energy is the force, if you will, or the energy that is blowing the universe apart, while dark matter is that which is holding it together. So are you talking about other forces, or are you talking about understanding the particles within dark matter or dark energy?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically, you know, dark matter and dark energy are just labels for unknown things. So yeah, dark matter is some kind of gravitating substance that holds galaxies together and clusters of galaxies together. Dark energy is some kind of repulsive force, but we don't know what causes them. It's a bit like looking into the universe and saying, oh, we can see stars and galaxies. And we can say, oh, that's just made of matter. But imagine that we didn't know what an atom was. We didn't know what an electron or a quark was. Like, we know what those things are made of because on Earth, we've been able to detect the basic building blocks of matter in experiments. And so we can say with confidence, a distant galaxy is made of electrons and quarks and the stuff that we're made of as well. But when we look into the universe and we see evidence of dark matter and dark energy, we have absolutely no fundamental understanding of what they are. They are just descriptions for astronomical phenomena. And what we want is a fundamental understanding of what is dark matter made of. You know, is it one particle? Is it a whole set of particles? A bit like our visible universe is made of lots of particles. Like, the dark sector could be quite interesting and rich. There could even be structures made of dark matter. That's not yet excluded. So we really don't know anything about these huge sectors of the universe, basically. And that's what we are trying to figure out. And that's why we think there must be new stuff out there to be found in experiments here on Earth.
And is that part of your goal there with the project at CERN, the LHCb experiment, to identify some of these particles and some of these forces?
Yeah, I mean, so there are lots of theoretical ideas for what dark matter could be or what dark energy could be. But the problem is that we've looked for them, and we've, you know, certain types of particle would show up in certain types of experiments, and lots of experiments of different types have been done. So far, nothing has been found. So what's happened in the last, you know, few decades is we've ruled out a whole set of possible explanations for what dark matter and dark energy could be, but we still haven't found the explanation itself. And yeah, I mean, so at LHCb, what we are doing is in a sense, it's quite a broad approach to looking for generically new things that we haven't seen before. Basically, what the experiment does, the B in LHCb stands for beauty, which is the name of one of the six quarks. So there's this thing called the beauty quark. It doesn't exist normally in the universe, but we make them in very large numbers in the collisions at the Large Hadron Collider, and then our experiment detects them, essentially. And what we're looking for is we study these particles and we make precise measurements of them. And the basic game is you have your theory, the Standard Model. It predicts how these beauty quarks should behave. And then you do an experiment where you measure how they behave and you compare them. And if you see a difference between theory and experiment, that could be indirect evidence that the beauty quarks are being affected by, say, a new force that we've never seen before. So it's a little bit like... if you're looking for the analogy I often use is if you're looking for an animal in a jungle, and the jungle might be very, very big and dark, and the chances of actually stumbling upon the animal itself might be quite slim. So a more canny strategy is to sort of look at the ground and, can you see footprints? Can you see broken branches? Do you see animal droppings? And by seeing these indirect hints on things you can see, that gives you clues to what the overall animal is. So that's sort of what we're doing at LHCb. The beauty quarks are almost like, you know, a kind of a known landscape, and we're looking for the impressions on their behavior left by unseen heavier particles that we've not discovered yet.
But it may be that, for example, with your observations of the beauty particle, that in the end that they do conform with the standard model. It's not necessarily that this is taking you down the path of a new model or finding a new force. It may be that it actually conforms the way that the Higgs boson did, that it actually fits in within the standard model.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, that's a piece of knowledge that we would then have. So, you know, what we do, we're trying to fill in the gap. So we found all the particles in the standard model, but we haven't tested everything the standard model predicts. In fact, you know, with the Higgs boson, for example, we only have quite a blurry picture of the Higgs at the moment. And one of the reasons we continue to do experiments is to try to get a better picture of this. Is the Higgs boson really the Higgs boson predicted by Peter Higgs and his colleagues back in the 60s? Or is it something different? Is it something more exotic? That's still not ruled out. So the whole purpose, I suppose, of particle physics is to perform measurements to test these theories in lots of different areas and see if the theory works, that's great. But if there's a place where the theory breaks down, that's very exciting, because that's giving us a clue as to how you extend the theory. Because we fundamentally know that the standard model cannot be the final theory of the universe, because there are these big questions that it cannot answer. So what we're truly trying to find is these chinks in the armor of this very successful theory, which will basically allow us to sort of, to mix metaphors, break open a doorway that we can then use to access a new unseen part of the universe. So yeah, that's, I mean, most of the time when you do these measurements, as you say, they do agree with the standard model, they confirm the theory. But with these anomalies, what we're hoping is that eventually one of them will solidify and turn into a very clear sign that there really is something new out there. And that will give us then a target, a bit like finding a footprint in the jungle. Oh, right, the animal looks a bit like this, and we're going to go off in that direction and try and find it directly.
Phil, Play, your thoughts on that discussion about discovering the Higgs boson and just everything that Harry Cliff was saying about the challenge facing particle physicists.
Particle physics is in a funny spot right now. The standard model, and I've never really liked that name, because it sounds complete. It's our standard model. It kind of explains everything, and it really doesn't. So there's got to be something else going on, because we know dark energy and dark matter are out there affecting the universe and everything in it. So there is some things that the standard model does not predict, simply because it's not really designed to.
Well, here's a thought experiment. Particle physicists detected the Higgs boson, but what if they hadn't? How would scientists have responded then?
Isaac Asimov, the science fiction writer and also scientist himself, said that science doesn't progress when somebody looks into a microscope and says, "Eureka!" It's when they look into a microscope and say, "Huh, that's funny." And that's where we are, that's where we were with the Higgs boson. The standard model really predicted a lot about it, including its mass, its energy, all these things about it. And when they found it, it pretty much fit. So that's wonderful in that it says your theories, your models are working. That's good. But I don't know if there's a particle physicist out there, the ones I know, who would have been unhappy if it had been way off. Because then you're like, oh, look at that. That's not what we were expecting at all. There's more fun here to know about. So I think that's true of most scientists. When you get a result you're not expecting, it's always great to be shown to be right. You know, it's always nice to say, oh, my pet theory worked out and everything's great. Where you start making the exploration is at the frontier. It's when something does not fit and you have to say, oh, there's more going on here than we thought, and that's cool.
Phil, if you had a dog, or if you do have a dog, have you ever thought about naming your dog or your cat Theory?
Theory?
So then it could be your pet Theory.
My pet Theory, I see. I did have a cat named Schrodinger.
Who kept appearing and disappearing.
Yes, exactly.
Depending. Next, we meet another subatomic particle called the glue ball. Any guess what its role is in the structure of the universe? We're going beyond the standard model on Big Picture Science. We're talking about how new physics experiments are shaking up cosmology and our understanding of the universe. And there's a lot more we're going to hear, but Phil, it seems like one of the takeaways already is that science doesn't proceed in a straight line. It's not like science proceeds like one would cruise down a major interstate, right? Just straight from point A to point B. It's more like you get off on a service road occasionally.
Well, that's kind of true. You know, we start with our knowledge of our as our starting point. We have some destination. We may not know what it is. And so we're trying to get there and figure out what's going on between those two points. So it's not so much you're driving on an interstate, is that you're building it as you're moving along and trying to figure it all out. And if you just wind up making a straight line between two points, you're missing out on all the really cool stuff.
Well, in our second half of our interview with physicist Harry Cliff, he describes a particle that scientists have only recently detected. It was certainly new to me. And what it would mean to discover a new force and go beyond the standard model of particle physics. But first, I asked Dr. Cliff to help us relate to these subatomic particles. To what degree should we think about them as being out there, part of the universe, you know, created in the Big Bang? And to what degree are they a part of us, part of our everyday lives?
I mean, they are us, right? I mean, that's what we are. We are basically walking very complicated collections of fundamental particles stuck together in a mixture of different ways. I mean, you know, in some sense, all of these particles are within us in one way or another. So the basic structure of an atom is that you have a nucleus with electrons going around the outside. The electron was the first fundamental particle to be discovered. So we are made of electrons, for one thing. And then in the nucleus, you have these things called protons and neutrons. But protons and neutrons are not fundamental. If you look inside them, inside these particles, there are these things called quarks. So you have a proton and a neutron are both made of three quarks stuck together, basically, in like a bound state. But as you look closer, you start to see other things appearing. So heavier quarks that kind of come in and out of existence through quantum mechanics are in there inside the proton. You have these things called gluons. And as you look closer, the more you see and the more detail you see, and you start to see really heavy things like the Higgs boson itself inside the proton. So in some sense, all of the particles that we know about are within us in one way or another. So, and the whole universe. So, you know, we kind of, in some sense, we are a microcosm of the universe itself. What we contain is what the entire universe is made from. And that's what makes particle physics powerful as a subject, because it means we can take ordinary matter on Earth and we can do things to it to study its structure. And that can tell us not just about ourselves and the world around us, but also about very distant objects like galaxies, but or indeed things that happened the very furthest moments, the earliest moments of the Big Bang.
I love that. So that connects us directly, not abstractly, to the universe itself. And perhaps it was Carl Sagan who said this, we are stardust. And we're looking for some of the evidence of what makes up that stardust.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we are the atoms in our bodies were forged inside stars billions of years ago. But you can go back even further. Those stars formed out of matter that was created during the Big Bang in the first microsecond of the universe's existence. So, you know, we are Big Bang stuff as well. And we can actually speak with quite a lot of confidence about the entire history of the universe back to about a millionth of a second after the Big Bang. But that first millionth of a second, which times like a tiny amount of time, that is the time when all the stuff that we are made from ultimately was created. And we don't really understand yet how that happened. And that is partly what we're doing at the Large Hadron Collider. We are recreating energies and densities and conditions that existed in those very earliest moments so that we can try and fill in that missing blank in our understanding of the universe's history and therefore where we came from.
Well, Harry, I love the names for some of these particles. You know, you have the tau neutrino, and we have the up quarks, and we have the down quarks, and we have the beauty quark. And I think that scientists have just detected the particle called the glue ball. What is a glue ball? And I'm assuming it helps hold things together.
Yeah, I mean, so a glue ball, to understand what a glue ball is, you first have to understand what a proton is made of. So a proton is one of the particles in the nucleus. It's made of three quarks, and those quarks are held together by something called the strong force. So the strong force is one of the three fundamental forces that we understand in particle physics. The fourth is gravity, but we don't understand gravity at all. And the particles that transmit the strong force are called gluons. So a gluon is called a gluon because they're basically like these really, really strong springs. You could think of them like tiny, tiny springs that hold the quarks together inside the proton. So the quarks can't escape from the proton because of these very strong gluons holding them together. Now, the gluon is a bit of a weird force particle. If you think of it, if you compare it to the particle of electromagnetism, so which is the photon, this is the particle of light. If you have two photons, because photons don't have electric charge, they don't interact with each other. So if you fire two photons at each other, they just go straight past each other, almost always. Whereas gluons, they actually carry the charge of the strong force, which means they stick to each other. So in principle, that means that you can get rid of the quarks and just have gluons that are sort of stuck together like a load of entangled springs in some sense. And they form this particle called a glue ball. So it's basically a particle that is made only of gluons and doesn't have any quarks in it. We've never seen such a thing before, but they are predicted by the theory of the strong force. And just, I think it was last week, that one an experiment called BES3 saw some evidence that they had found a glue ball hidden in a particular particle decay. So this is very exciting because it's telling us something new about the strong force. So when we say, you know, the Standard Model is finished, well, it's not really finished because there are all these things it predicts, these phenomena, which maybe are not fundamental new particles, but they are things that the universe can do that we've never seen the universe do before. And this is a new thing that the universe can do that we've seen happen, which is really exciting.
So the Standard Model does predict the glue ball, and I have to say it does sound like something I played with, that we all played with in elementary school.
Yeah.
So the more that we learn about the behavior of the glue ball, the more that we may reinforce the Standard Model, because as you said, it is predicted by it. So this would not be a challenge to the Standard Model and pointing us in the direction of new physics.
No, not necessarily, but it's interesting, actually. So we say we understand the Standard Model, but in some sense, we don't really. And there's this thing that is kind of slightly weird it may seem weird to a non-scientist, which is you can have a theory and think it's the correct theory, but it can sometimes be very hard to actually calculate the consequences of your theory. So the same thing happens in the Standard Model, actually. The theory of the strong force is very well defined, but it's incredibly difficult to actually calculate properties of particles made of quarks and gluons. The theories is very hard to calculate with. So when we see something like a glue ball, that gives us a handle on, are the approximate methods that we use to figure out what should happen from the theory correct? You know, and so actually, it's maybe not telling us so much about, well, it's telling us, is the way that we translate our theory into predictions right? And if we discover it's not, that can actually have knock-on effects on our understanding of the theory itself. So the Standard Model is by no stretch a done deal. And while the glue ball is not like going to explain dark matter necessarily, it can tell us about one of the three fundamental forces, which we still don't fully understand.
Harry, you're obviously very excited about physics in general and also the possibility of perhaps new physics. What is it that excites you about these questions that you and other scientists are trying to answer? How does it drive you?
I think I don't see how you wouldn't be excited by these questions, right? I mean, you're talking about what are we made from? Why are we, well, not why are we here, but how did we get here? You know, how did the universe create the world that we live in? I don't think there are many more profound questions than that. So I think that's in a really big picture sense, that's what has always excited me about physics. It's this idea that you can explain all the complexity in the world around us. And the world is incredibly rich and complicated, you know, in terms of relatively simple basic ingredients operating under relatively simple natural laws. I think that's such a kind of beguiling idea that there's this deep order to the universe and that, you know, on the surface, it seems random and crazy. And you think about, you know, things like human beings and our behavior. I think there's something kind of magical about the idea that, you know, thought and minds and human beings emerge out of these very basic ingredients operating under these dumb laws that somehow give rise to all this complexity. So that's kind of the really big picture that excites me.
Help us understand what it would mean to discover a new force in the universe. And is that something that would come through one experiment and there would be a discovery the way, or a detection the way that there was with the Higgs boson? Or is that something that would emerge over many, many experiments and then maybe 10 or 15 years from now we'll say, okay, I think we have enough information here, enough evidence here to suggest there's something else going on?
Yeah. I mean, so, well, first of all, maybe why would a new force be exciting? It would be exciting because it would take us beyond the standard model. And it would very likely be connected to some of these big puzzles. You know, what is dark matter? How did the universe come into existence? Why do we have the particular particles that we see in the standard model? Like in the standard model, it's almost like we're seeing a fraction of some bigger pattern. We haven't got the full picture yet. And if we see more of that pattern, that will help us figure out what the whole picture looks like. So there are many reasons why it would be really exciting. And that's actually, you know, so in my book, Space Oddities, a lot of the anomalies that I discuss in the book are coming from different experiments all over the world where people are seeing evidence of things that can't be explained in terms of our current understanding of physics. And in several cases, these relate to new forces. Now, it could be that these different experiments are all seeing aspects of the same phenomena from different angles, or it could be they're seeing things that are completely unrelated to each other. We don't yet know. But in terms of how this gets confirmed, I mean, I think it sort of depends. Sometimes in physics or science, one experiment is enough to say we've discovered something. But usually that's not the case, particularly for something really revolutionary like a new force. Even if one experiment said, look, we've got hard evidence now, we're really convinced that there's something going on here, what you would really want is other experiments to cross-check what they had done, make sure there wasn't a mistake. But also, this new force wouldn't just show up in one place. So, for example, if we saw that beauty quarks were being affected by a new force, well, that new force would also probably affect other particles and other experiments. So we would want to design a whole suite of experiments that gradually give you different angles on the same thing and event and allow you to fill in the picture. And it's going back to that analogy of the animal in the jungle, it's a bit like one experiment's found a footprint, but you know that doesn't really tell you, you know, how high, how tall is this animal, you know. So maybe you, someone else finds a broken branch at a certain height and go, okay, it's 6 foot tall and it's got five toes or whatever. So that's kind of the approach. And basically, once you get corroborating evidence from multiple sources, not only can you really be confident that you found something, but you also start to be able to paint a picture of what this thing is.
Well, finally, Harry, is it too soon to start floating names for what this new force of nature might be called, if there is one? I mean, we have the eponymous Higgs boson. If you were the one to discover the new force, would it be the cliff force? Ha,
definitely not. I think it is quite an anomaly that Higgs got his name attached to it. That doesn't normally happen, but I think it was a bit of good luck, really, on his part. I think in terms of, I mean, there already are, for all of these anomalies, there are theoretical proposals out there for what the new force or the new particle could be. And they have, lots of them have very esoteric sounding names. This one force called a Z prime, another one called a leptoquark. That you name it, you get dark forces, dark photons, you know, all kinds of strange names. As for, you know, what, but it, I think it is too early to say, really. We have all these multiple explanations, and that's because we have really quite scant evidence at the moment. And the evidence isn't yet really solid enough even to say that we found something. So we really are at the stage of, you know, we found a couple of footprints. We can't say what this animal is. And maybe actually it's just an animal we've already seen and know about that's behaving a bit weirdly, that's making us think we're discovering a new animal. So it's too early to give it a label. And I think that will come in time. As we get more evidence, we'll be able to distinguish between these different possible scenarios and actually say, okay, this thing definitely is a dark photon or a leptoquark or what have you.
And do we call the Z prime the Z prime here,
yes,
on this
you,
side of the Atlantic?
I guess you would call it the Z prime. Yeah, apologies.
Just doing a little translation there. Well, Harry Cliff, thank you so much for talking to us about what really is the big picture, the nature and the structure of the universe.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Harry Cliff is a particle physicist at the University of Cambridge, and he works on the LHCb experiment at the largest particle physics laboratory in the world, CERN. He is the author of Space Oddities, the mysterious anomalies challenging our understanding of the universe. And I guess oddities is the key word there, Phil. The universe is odd.
Yeah, it's pretty weird. And the more we look at it, the weirder it seems to get.
You know, Phil, when I think about this idea that everything was created in the Big Bang, in this fraction of a second, all of these particles, these forces, and the structure of the universe, and we don't mean like the planets and the observable universe, because that did take time, but was it all there in that instant? I can't get my head around it.
It was. The Big Bang is misconstrued a lot by the public. People think of it as an explosion in space. All this stuff was packed really tightly, and then it just blew up and scattered everywhere. And in a sense, that's true, but it wasn't an explosion in space. It was an explosion of space. It was literally space itself, and all the energy in it was all in this one spot, and then it was expanding. But it's not expanding into anything, because it is its own thing. And that's probably the hardest thing to wrap your head around. But once you kind of, once you accept it, you realize, oh, sure, in the first, you know, 0.00030 zeros with a one after it, seconds after the Big Bang, there were these one kind of particles. But then as the universe expanded and cooled, you get these changes in the universe at certain times. And in that first fraction of a second, that's a very, very short amount of time to us. But to the universe and to these forces that were operating at the time, it was a huge amount of time to do all kinds of stuff. And it wasn't until really 3 minutes after the Big Bang that all the sort of protons and neutrons and everything that we are familiar with, that the universe was cool enough, basically, literally in temperature, that these things could form and be stable. And after that, they were able to collect into clumps and then stars and planets and moons and doorknobs and grass and elephants and everything we see around us.
Well, Phil, as the science questions get stranger, and they are getting stranger, the experiments attempting to answer them become less straightforward. Are you ready to hear about how a spacecraft flying near the sun could help unlock new physics?
Absolutely. I like cool, new, sophisticated spacecraft.
All right. Well, buckle up as we continue to go beyond the standard model on Big Picture Science. As physics experiments turn up unexpected results, our questions about the universe become more focused, and sometimes the instruments needed to answer them become more complex. We've come a long way from Galileo dropping two balls of unequal weight off the Leaning Tower of Pisa to test gravity. And now as I say that, Phil, I'm not sure if that's not apocryphal. Did that really happen?
Well, actually, there's no evidence that actually happened. It may have just been a thought experiment. Although, I gotta say, it is kind of Galileo style, some big splashy thing. He could have just dropped a couple of balls off of a tree or just any old building, but off the Leaning Tower, that's very much in his wheelhouse, something very splashy like that.
So we've come a long ways from that. Consider that the search for the Higgs boson required not just a particle accelerator, but the biggest in the world, the Large Hadron Collider. And it is essentially a huge circular tunnel with a 16-mile circumference that's over 500 feet underground. And Phil, why do we need such large instruments to detect such tiny interactions?
Well, because they're tiny. We're talking about effects that are very subtle and very difficult to measure. If you want to get something easy, like the charge on an electron, that's something you can do in a high school physics classroom. And I've done that experiment. Didn't get a great answer, but, you know, pretty close. But if you want to find out much more complicated things about how electrons interact with each other, how they fit in with all of the other particles and forces in the universe, you need to have more and more sophisticated experiments. And we are at the point in science now where a lot of these fundamental questions have been answered. And if we want to get into the weeds, we want to figure out the details, yeah, we need complex experiments to do that.
So when we read that NASA is proposing an experiment to unlock new physics, we were prepared for it to be complex, but this proposal was still baffling upon first read. Phil, we sent the paper over to you before we, you know, met today. Did you read it?
I read it. I read it. I can confidently say that. In fact, the abstract and the first page were pretty good, and I understand kind of overall what they're doing. But of course, you know, this type of physics that they are looking into is a bit above my pay grade. So I think I will allow the people involved with it to describe it.
Well, Phil, as an astronomer, you can help us set this experiment up, because we do need to know something about galaxy rotation speeds. And all of this will be made clear in just a moment. But could you explain for us why the rotation speed of galaxies is perplexing scientists? Give us the background on this.
Galaxies like the Milky Way, our spiral galaxy that we live in, spin around, they rotate. And that rotation depends on the gravity of all the stuff in it. So if you have a star that's near the center or a star that's near the edge, how long they take to orbit around the center, that depends on the gravity that they feel. And we can do a pretty decent job calculating that. We can look at a galaxy and say, well, it's emitting this much light, and so it's got this many stars in it, and this much gas, and this much dust, and everything else. We can add all that mass up, calculate how strong the gravity is, measure the rotation, and see if we've got a good match. And it turns out, we don't. Galaxies do not rotate in the way that our simple gravitational models predicted. And it turns out that there must be a lot more mass in these galaxies than we can see. It is made of matter, but it's dark. And so we call it dark matter. But we're not 100% sure. And if it is out there and doing all of this, what is it? How does it behave? What is it doing? These are all questions that we need answers to.
All right, well, we're about to get answers to some of those questions, I think. That is what the unexpected rotational speed of galaxies says about the universe. And luckily, Seth Shostak was able to chat with NASA JPL astrophysicist Slava Turyashev about the aims of this new experiment and language we can understand.
So basically, when we look at galaxies, they do not obey Newton's law. So realistically, it looks like we are missing some matter in the galaxies. So that's how the idea of dark matter came to be. That was one puzzle. But late 1990s, we dealt with another puzzle. We realized that our universe does not obey the laws we expected it to obey. So it looks like something is pushing the universe from within. So there is something called dark energy, which is a mysterious force that accelerates the expansion of the universe.
So, Slava, what you're saying is that galaxies, big spiral galaxies, we have lots of photos of these things, are spinning too quickly in their outer regions, too quickly based on what you expect from, you know, from 17th century physics, right? Is that the anomaly that we're trying to explain?
Exactly. And the arms of those spiral galaxies tell us the velocity with which those spiral galaxies rotate. So they actually rotate much faster. So that meaning they're hidden mass. If we follow the Newton's law, that implies that there should be additional mass, but we just don't see where that mass is coming from. And so this is first smoking gun, essentially, on the violation of modern physics. And that's what we would like to understand.
Just a personal thing, Slava. When I was a grad student, not terribly far away from you at Caltech, we were measuring the rotation of galaxies. That was the thing we were trying to do, and we could do it. And the big surprise to me, one that caused me to lose a lot of sleep, or at least some sleep, was that they were spinning too quickly in their outer regions. They had what we called flat rotation curves, and that was totally unexpected. Everybody expected they were going to be following Newton's law, and rotation speed would drop in the outer regions of these galaxies, and it didn't. We never called it dark matter.
And I jumped into this field completely from a different perspective. I realized that, you know, dark matter is here, and the flat galaxy rotation curves are just amazing anomaly for me. So it's like trying to explain it with other new fields, maybe black holes, primordial black holes, or some, you know, some gravity modification. So it's amazing field, very interesting. And I guess we are living in a very interesting time where all those puzzles will, I'm confident, they will lead to new discoveries.
So you're going to do an experiment. Can you tell me briefly what the experiment might be?
We looked at multiple possibilities how to detect the presence of dark energy or dark matter in a local environment around the sun. And what we realized that if those forces are uniform, so they're present in everywhere in the universe, they should be present also in the solar system, but they will be very much hidden by the local gravity. So we need to go deeper. We need to understand our gravity in the solar system much better. And so our experiment is very simple. We will fly four spacecraft in something called tetrahedron formation, and also very good timing between the spacecraft. We will be able to detect the presence of very tiny anomalies in the gravitational field in the solar system.
Your experiment is trying to fly a phalanx of four spacecraft and measure the distances between them, right? How accurately can you do that?
We are able to track these distances to a precision of less than the subatomic distances, very tiny. And that will allow us to track any small anomalies, any small deviations from the known physics to very high precision. We will be looking for everything that is anomalous in the behavior of planets in the solar system.
So four spacecraft here, I mean, presumably you could do it maybe with two or three. You're doing four presumably to make sure that the result is not the result of noise in the system or, you know, small effects that you're not really interested in. Give me some idea of how far apart these four spacecraft are going to be.
Excellent question. So we have initially those four spacecraft will be separated by about 1,000 kilometers, not far. And so we will form the tetrahedron very close to the sun, about the orbit of Venus. And then as they move in their elliptical orbits, the distances of between the spacecraft will increase by 16 times as they move away to almost the orbit of Mars. So you can imagine that this tetrahedron formation, it will be contracting and then expanding, and it also will be rotating. And because of that rotation, our system will be submerged to different type of inertial forces. Inertial forces, Coriolis force, some centrifugal forces. To compensate for those forces, we will deploy another observable, something called Sagnac interferometer. So with the Sagnac interferometer, we need to have not two, not three, but four spacecraft, because now we will be able to compensate for this angular velocity of that tetrahedron in three dimensions and compensate for any non-inertial motion.
Okay, so what you're saying is the minimum number of spacecraft you can use to do this experiment, so you don't get confused by other, you know, either conventional forces, is four. I mean, it's not that you want to spend more money, it's that that's what you need to do the experiment.
Correct. And four spacecraft is the unique configuration that allows us to completely detach ourselves from any other fields in the solar system.
When will this experiment happen? These spacecraft aren't flying right now. When do you anticipate that they will be?
Now we have proven that this concept will work. Now we need to develop technologies, and those technologies and put them in a small spacecraft form factor. So we hope that this experiment will fly in about 10 to 15 years from now.
Okay, so this is the horizon for getting a result in this mission. It's not next week. You're talking about a decade in the future. You know, Slava, if I'm just the man in the street, I might ask, okay, so there's a very tiny effect here, and what I learned about the behavior of gravity in high school physics, for example, is, you know, not exactly right. But so what? Why should I care if I'm just, you know, a non-scientist in the general population?
That's a wonderful question. What we are talking about is how well do we know the place we live in, the universe. So how universe began, and what is the physics that govern the evolution of the universe? Do we understand it well? What was there before universe began, before the Big Bang? So this is a very fundamental questions for our own existence in the universe. And if we understand that there will be additional force, there may be a fifth interaction, which we are looking for. And so if this will be the fifth interaction, that may be a profound effect on the physics, the modern physics. And as we know, at some point, new physical laws become technologies. At some point, we will be able to understand how these technologies may help us maybe travel faster in the universe, maybe communicate between different, you know, civilizations in the universe. But the most profound effect is really to understand the place we live in, the universe.
Slava Teryashev, thanks so very much for speaking to us.
Very nice to be here. Thank you for your interest in our work, and we will be in touch, and this work will be developed very soon. We will talk more about this.
Slava Teryashev is an astrophysicist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Okay, well, Phil, your thoughts on that experiment? Was the explanation clearer than the paper was?
I think so. So this spacecraft is going to consist of four different independently flying sub-spacecraft. And they're going to communicate with each other and measure exactly their distances between all the different four components. And when I mean exact, I mean, he mentioned picometers. You know, a nanometer is a trillionth of a meter. That's already, you know, subatomic size. He's talking about a picometer, which is a thousandth of a nanometer, a quadrillionth of a meter. This is incredibly small. But by using lasers, they're going to beam lasers at each other and talk to each other and be able to figure out their distances to that sort of accuracy. And what that means is, well, The sun has gravity. Earth, moon, Jupiter has, they all have gravity. All of these objects are going to affect how these spacecraft are separated from each other. Once you can compensate for all of those things and you get to smaller and smaller effects, at some point, what you're hoping to see is maybe something left over. Maybe this is modifications of Newtonian dynamics, Mond, as he mentioned. This is the strength of gravity that is not what we think it is. Or maybe it's exactly what we think it is, and in fact, it's just dark matter out there that's affecting everything.
Well, finally then, Phil, do you think we will ever have a complete understanding of the universe? And will we have to change the name Standard Model, or will we just tweak it and have a better standard model? But the question is, will we ever know?
Well, they'll probably come up with the meta standard model and then the beyond the meta standard model and then, you know, the hyper meta standard. That's the way astronomers tend to do things, because we had nova and then supernova and then hypernova, because you just start running out of modifiers. I don't know if we'll ever fully understand the universe. Every time we think we do, there's more stuff going on. And I think that's sort of the science standard model now, is to assume that, yeah, there's just stuff we don't know, and there's always going to be more stuff we don't know. If that's the way things are, that makes me happy, because the worst part about doing a puzzle is also the best part, is when you finish it. It's wonderful to be able to look at that picture and go, wow, look at that, that's so cool. And then you're like, but that's it, we're done. There's no more fun to be done. So with the universe, it's a puzzle made of an infinite number of pieces. That's my hope, and we will always have more to learn about it.
Well, we've learned more about all of this thanks to you, Phil. Thank you again for joining us to help us make sense of these new frontiers in physics and astronomy.
It's literally my pleasure. Thank you.
Phil Plait is an astronomer and science communicator who writes for Scientific American. His most recent book is Under Alien Skies, A Sightseer's Guide to the Universe. Well, this show would not be possible without the non-standard talents of senior producer Gary Niederhoff and assistant producers Brian Edwards and Shannon Rose Geary. I am the executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley.
Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit education and research organization that studies life in all its complexity. I'm the Institute's senior astronomer, Seth Shostak. Also, a big thanks to our listeners and our Patreon supporters.
The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This episode of Big Picture Science, about why the universe is stranger than we thought, is called Beyond the Standard Model. We'll be right back.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7